Chapter 12. 1:12:1. The stench of blood and charred flesh was strong in Cor Faron's nostrils. The bulk of Lorgar close at hand was dominating but reassuring, the drip of fluid from his fingers a faint drumbeat on the deck.
"My son,"
whispered the priest, overcome with emotion. He placed his splayed fingers upon the wound in Lorgar's shoulder, but the youth did not flinch from the touch. Already the tissue was healing, the raw edges of the cauterization softening into fresh muscle and skin.
"It will pass, my master."
Lorgar turned his gaze over the rail to the cloud of dust that marked the passage of the mutineers.
"We are well rid of them."
Cor Faron's heart hardened again.
"Foolish Lorgar," he said. "Torsja was correct. One does not leave an enemy to recover. When one strikes, one must do so to the fullest extent of power, to leave no foe remaining that might challenge the victor."
"They will not return," Lorgar replied. "No water, no food. The sun wolves will be picking their bones within days."
Cor Faron chose not to admonish Lorgar for omitting his title, judging the moment too precarious to waste on such trivialities. As always, his view was from a loftier position, seeing further than those around him. The only thing he believed in more than the word and the truth was the persistence of enemies.
"It takes only one to bring word of your existence to Varadesh," he explained slowly,
as though Lorgar were an infant again. His ward thought too well of people and circumstance. It left him vulnerable to the vicissitudes of the power's arcane plans and the petty ambitions of mortals who would deny that design. Cor Faron wafted a hand towards the dead traitors around them.
"If any doubted your origins in the Imperium before this day, none do so now. All will desire to court you or destroy you if they hear of what you can do."
He grabbed Lorgar's bloodied hand in his fingers, clutching it tightly, earnestly. Cor Faron did not fear death or indignation, or any of the petty tremors in other men's hearts. Righteousness put right any dread of such mortal concerns. But he was not carved from rock.
"You have been led to me, son, and I to you. The powers have willed this to be, and thus shall it be. But there are those who would not have it so, who would allow their vanity to overturn the will of the powers. The Covenant is the strongest church of Colchis, and by whatever means they will learn of you, Lorgar. If just one of those faithless dogs brings word to another, as the cold of the night follows the heat of the day, we can be sure that tribe by tribe, trader by trader, city by city, the news of your being shall reach Varadesh. And when it does, the despots of that city, the tyrants who chain the faithful to the drudgery of recitations and empty ceremony, will see you dead. Or worse, your glory bent beneath the yoke of their empty worship, for they will suffer no other, not even the powers, to eclipse them in praise."
As was his way, Cor Faron did not have to specify his desire, for it was plain from circumstance what needed to be done. Through him, the truth was known, even though he did not have to give voice to the word. 1:12:2.
"Say no," whispered Nairo,
barely breathing the words, remembering the keen hearing of Lorgar. The boy made no indication that he had heard the slave, and for a moment did not respond to the emotional petition of Cor Faron.
"I will come," said Axata,
bending a knee to the master and acolyte.
"To atone for the mistake and the peril I unleashed upon this blessed congregation."
The offer was repeated by the guards who had remained with the leader of the converts, and they bowed to the deck before Lorgar.
"No."
The youth spoke but one word, giving no further argument, yet it was absolute, as final as the sound of a tomb lid falling into place. He stared towards the side of the deck, heading for the ladder.
"They will be prepared this time,"
Axata warned, rising.
"Perhaps," said Lorgar, not looking back.
"They have weapons,"
Axata proffered his pistol to the youth.
"You should take something too."
Lorgar considered this, looking at the gun.
"Weapons are a falsehood, giving the weak the illusion that they are strong."
He smiled at Exarta, and it seemed as though the sun penetrated the shade for a heartbeat. But I take your point. Lorgar paced the deck, looking around the temple rig. In the aft section had been stored the remains of several of the vehicles broken apart during the crossing of the Low Barrens. The youth rifled through the parts for a short while, and then turned, the axle of a cart in one hand, the heavy head of a mast sensor in the other. He pushed the spiked iron globe onto the shaft, his fingers bending the metal into place. In one hand he raised the mace, a weapon heavier than anything Exarta could have carried.
"Wait for me here," said Lorgar.
And there was no arguing with his command, even from Corferon, whose nature made him oppose on instinct any who tried to instruct him.
"Stay safe,"
said Nairo, the sentiment echoed by a few other slaves as the youth climbed onto the ladder. His last glance was for Corferon. The priest returned the look with customary indifference.
"Make me proud, child," said the preacher. "Spare none."
And with that, Lorgar descended. Nairo, Exarta, and many others crowded the rail, watching the boys stride across the sands. Corferon gave a contemptuous snort and headed to his cabin.
"It is in the hands of the powers now,"
he declared before descending below deck. The slaves and remaining converts stayed watching until long after Lorgar had been swallowed by the haze of distance and the wind had erased his footprints. 1.12.3 Following Lorgar's departure, a strange mood fell upon the caravan. Corferon did not emerge from isolation, occasionally shouting demands for fresh water and food, but communicating no more than that. The slaves performed such duties as necessary for the bare minimum requirements of hygiene and sustenance. The guards, barely a quarter of their number remained, were reluctant to enforce any further labour upon those below them, now outnumbered a further threefold by the departure of the mutineers. There remained a possibility that the heretics who had turned away from the truth might return, but to patrol and post sentries would leave the converts with barely a handful of warriors to act as wardens on the temple rig. Some of the slaves, Lasai acting as spokesperson, demanded that they be armed from the lockers, arguing that the converts who remained would be no match for those who had been chased away. To the converts, this was not only a practical nightmare, but also an injunction against all they had been taught by Corferon. Exarta and Nairo came to a quick arrangement that the guards would not administer any punishments whilst the slaves would make no attempt to harm either the converts or Corferon. Neither group could exist without the other for the time being, nor was willing to challenge the quickly established status quo. To cement this agreement, the two factions prayed together, asking the powers for guidance and protection and strength in the trying times. They cursed the mutineers as faithless and implored the powers to strike down those who had turned from the truth. 1.12.4 The wakemane of Long Noon passed without incident, as did Resteve. Wakerise came without sight or sound of Lorgar or the mutineers returning. Corferon did not emerge from his prayers, studies, or whatever activity kept him in his quarters, which suited both the converts and the slaves well. The truce that had been established continued through three more meals and prayer sessions, and endured into Duskeve also. At the crest of Wakemane on Duskeve, as twilight hastened towards Coldfall, Exarta approached Nairo.
"I have a fear," he confessed to the old slave. "The Deniers had little time gained on Lorgar before he left. It would not have taken this long for him to catch up with them."
"I agree. He would outpace them, and his endurance is endless," said Nairo. "He would have returned by now if he could."
"We must accept that he is lost to us."
Axata's dark eyes glittered with moisture at the thought, and the declaration caught Nairo's breath in his throat and constricted about his heart.
"Lorgar has become a martyr. Too young, he has been taken from us."
"I'll not give up hope," Nairo argued, fighting back the sadness that had seeped into his soul. He might have prevailed, and now, injured, lies waiting for us in the sands.
It is no comfort that he will die a slow death instead, moaned Exarta.
You misunderstand. We should send out a party to search for Lorga.
Such a group would have to be armed, Exarta replied,
eyes narrowing with suspicion.
If converts leave, the caravan would be defenseless if the mutineers return. Unless you think I would arm the slaves. Is that your intent?
Perhaps it is time that we show a little faith.
That the powers protect Lorga?
I do not doubt that. But that wasn't my meaning. We should show faith in each other.
I can't, Nairo. The Master's mood is as unpredictable as ever. The powers move him in strange ways. And can you tell me what he is thinking now, after everything that has just happened?
No, admitted Nairo. This treachery, your treachery, could send him beyond the edge of reason.
A precipice we can both agree he walks along at the best of times.
Nairo could not ignore this plain fact. If he examined his heart, he could not in conscience assure the safety of the priest, from himself or any of the other slaves.
We must leave it to the powers, Exarta declared suddenly. Their design will come to pass. It is not for mortals to judge.
I have always found that fatalistic, Exarta, said Nairo.
I don't mean that we'll do nothing, quite the opposite. I will take the converts at dawn tomorrow, but I will not arm you in our stead. If the mutineers come back, and not us, well, either we'll already be dead, or I promise I'll do my best to avenge you and the Master. And if you think to attack Cor Faron, know that the wrath of the powers will be unrelenting in vengeance for the bearer of their word.
Nairo saw that the giant had made up his mind, and thought that perhaps the absence of the guards would provide some opportunity yet to be seen. He did not tell the others, lest they fell to unnecessary scheming before the converts left, which might reach the ear of Exarta. The rest eve of Dusk Eve arrived, bringing its cold touch. Though tired, Nairo slept fitfully, agitated by the prospect of what cold fall might bring. 1.12.5 He turned the old pages again. Each leaf of the wafer-thin plastic curved without creasing, its sheer surface untouched by the ravages of time. Cor Faron ran a dirty finger along the inked lines, marvelling at the fluidity of the script, not seeing the ragged nail chewed to the skin. It was unlike the cuneiform that dominated the modern languages of Colchis, more akin to a flowing river of thought than isolated word forms. He looked at the beautiful illustrations, full of vibrant colour, even centuries, perhaps millennia after they had been crafted. The slender figures who represented the various rituals and prayer positions with their knowing eyes, superbly captured by crystalline threads of miraculous ink. The book was remarkably light in his hands. It was thin compared to the many weighty volumes that sat on the makeshift shelves, so that it felt as though he held no more than a feather. Cor Faron had often wondered what knowledge lay in the pages of the book, tantalizingly just out of reach. Was the answer he sought right here, hidden behind the words he could not read? Was it part of the powers' cosmic joke that they had given him the key to the truth, placed it right before his eyes, but blinded him to its presence? He cursed his own ineptitude, and cursed again the mania that fueled his mind. The fervour of faith burned so brightly, so hotly in his soul that it was impossible to resist. It was the fuel to his zeal, but it had a price, and now he had paid that account in terrible dues. A wavering hand wiped away the sweat from his brow, then moved to the moisture that wet his cheeks. He had sent away his son, sent him to his death most likely. More than that, he had deprived the world of the powers' great gift. Cor Faron hated that the powers had made him the bearer of the word.
He thought of the title and laughed, but in bitterness, not humour. The appellation had occurred to him in a fevered sleep, 10 days into his exile, burning in the desert. The books he had stolen from the temple had been his salvation, the shield against attack, the proof of his identity. He let the book fall from shivering fingers and stood up, reaching towards the other indecipherable tomes held on the wall. He pulled out one at random, its leather cover inlaid with the spotted remains of gold leaf, the title as distant from him as the Empyrean itself. Corferon threw it onto the floor and grabbed another, and this volume he let fall from numb fingers also, and the others. With sudden craving, he pulled from the chest shelf, toppling the books about his feet. The piles of bent pages and cracked spines reminded him of the old etchings, of heretics and martyrs bound to the stake, firewood around them, the flames scorching the sin from their flesh. He looked at the lantern, reached a trembling hand towards the oil-fueled light. Forlorn, he gazed down upon the works of the unknown authors and felt all purpose ebb from his body.